Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox. I'm the Compliance Evangelist, and I'd like to welcome you to episode 409 of the FCPA Compliance Report. Today, I have with me Ann Sultan. Ann is counsel at Miller & Chevalier, and we discuss the firm's autumn 2018 FCPA report. It's an always informative report, both with metrics, numbers, and substantive discussions of everything that has happened in that quarter. We take a look at what the highlights were and where things may be going. Before we begin, I'd like to tell you about a new exciting podcast which premieres on Wednesday, December 5th on the Compliance Podcast Network. It is Great Women in Compliance. This podcast is hosted by Mary Shirley and Lisa Fine, two top compliance practitioners, and they take a look at the contribution of and work of great women in compliance. It's going to be a great series. I know you'll enjoy it. Please check it out on the Compliance Podcast Network. It will be available on Panoply, Megaphone, iTunes, this site, JD Supra, and YouTube. This is Tom Fox, the FCPA Compliance Report, and Great Women in Compliance are productions of the Compliance Podcast Network. Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox, back for another episode, and you're in for a real treat today because I have Ann Sultan with me. Ann is counsel at Miller & Chevalier, and we're here to talk about one of my favorite quarterly documents, Miller's FCPA Autumn Review 2018, which was released earlier this month. So, Ann, first of all, thank you for taking the time to visit with me today.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your practice at Miller for the audience.
Yes, absolutely. So I'm counsel at Miller & Chevalier in the international department. I focus on FCPA investigations and compliance, and I'm fluent in Russian, so I tend to focus on Eastern Europe and Russia.
Wow. Well, in that case, I know you're definitely busy. This really is. Thank you for taking the time to visit with me today. But let's just move directly into the report. It's entitled International Alert. And as I said, the firm does it quarterly. They do an annual wrap-up. It's sliced and diced in a variety of different ways. But I was wondering if there were any themes that stood out for you or the firm that are noted in the report.
Thanks, Tom. Yeah, actually, three themes stood out for us. The first one is that basically, in the six actions that the SEC resolved this quarter, we saw a re-emphasis of several of the common challenges that publicly traded companies may face when they're seeking to comply specifically with the FCPA's accounting provisions. So, for example, there was an emphasis on the challenges of ensuring that employees at foreign subsidiaries submit appropriate supporting documentation for transactions and expenses. We saw that with the Stryker Corporation settlement. There was also an emphasis on the importance of ensuring that supporting documentation is in fact legitimate, especially with regard to the use of third-party vendors. And this came up in the Sanofi and Beam Suntory settlements. And then we saw how even well-designed gifts, travel and entertainment policies and procedures can fail if company personnel fail to follow them appropriately. And this was evident in the United Technology Corporation, UTC, settlement. The second major theme we saw was that both the DOJ and the SEC are continuing to wrap up long-running FCPA investigations. This is a theme that we've noted in previous reviews as well. Much of the conduct covered by the SEC's orders in particular this quarter occurred several years ago, in some cases ending in 2012, 2013, or 14. And this suggests that the SEC may be following a trend that we've seen over the past year in the DOJ's enforcement of the FCPA as well, in wrapping up these long-running, multi-year investigations. And it could potentially be with the aim of freeing up resources for the initiation of new investigations in the future. And finally, I would say that the third major theme we've seen is that the DOJ and the SEC, they continue to resolve a higher than average number of FCPA-related investigations without enforcement action. But they're doing this often without also officially declining to prosecute. So besides the two formal declinations under the FCPA corporate enforcement policy that we tracked this quarter, we also saw eight investigations into six companies by the DOJ and SEC all officially closed without action. And the companies that are affected by this are wide-ranging in terms of their geographic presence and their industry. Just to give you an example, we saw a utilities company from Brazil, Hertz, the car rental company, a China-based vaccine and biopharmaceutical company, UK-based offshore drilling contractor, and a Netherlands-based bank and financial services company all received these declinations.
So certainly with the first two themes, Anne, these almost seem to be themes that Miller's hit on before, certainly themes that we have seen before. But even with the third one, we have previously seen an increased number of declinations resolved without an enforcement action, without going through a declination with disgorgement or the predecessor to the corporate enforcement policy, the pilot program. So I guess my sense is, from at least your initial introduction, it's really just continuity from what we may have seen really over the past couple of years.
Yes, absolutely. I think there have been a lot of questions as to whether the administration that came in 2016 was going to change things up a lot. And what we've really seen, as you just said, is a sort of continuity that's lasted throughout the last couple of years. So no major changes.
And one of the things that really intrigued me about this quarter, as opposed to even other quarters in 2018, is we didn't really have with one notable exception, we didn't have a blockbuster case. And that notable exception was, of course, Petrobras. But you talked about the SEC enforcement actions. And what I found is, or what I found in reading those, was there was a lot of great information for the compliance practitioner to actually utilize, either to pressure test their compliance program or to perhaps incorporate current best practices. So I was wondering if we might be able to take some cases and actually look at them in a little bit of detail, starting with the Beam Suntory case, and hear what struck me and what I really wanted to ask you and draw upon your experience as a white collar practitioner is the effects of the Supreme Court's decision in the Kokesh case, and then how that decision would impact someone like yourself as a trusted advisor, giving advice to a company on whether they should sign or even consider a tolling agreement.
Yeah. So I'm sure that many listeners already know the background of the Kokesh decision, but just to recap quickly. So the decision from June 2017 said that the SEC's disgorgement claims constitute a penalty rather than an equitable remedy under the federal law and are therefore subject to the 5-year statute of limitations. What we saw under the Beam Suntory enforcement action was that the actions that took place, the conduct at issue, occurred from 2006 through 2012, but the SEC's enforcement action against Beam was initiated for statute of limitations purposes only in July of 2018, which means that the entire conduct at issue occurred outside of the 5-year statute of limitations. So it makes me wonder what the company might have done to bring that action within the SEC's jurisdiction. And so the two most likely scenarios, I think, are either that it entered into successive tolling agreements with the SEC, or that it just waived the statute of limitations issue in negotiating with the government. And so I think both of those, in light of Kokesh and in light of the SEC's common requests for tolling agreements or waiver, are things that advisors and outside counsel in particular need to take into consideration when speaking with clients and walking them through this process. Disgorgement has been a very important tool for the SEC just in the 5 years that preceded the Kokesh decision. The SEC's FCPA enforcement actions against companies yielded more than $2 billion for the commission, approximately 80% of which was from disgorged profits. So it's very clear that the SEC is motivated to continue to go after disgorged profits, and it'll be up to companies and their advisors to decide whether to enter into tolling agreements or waive any statute of limitations issues.
And I guess the other insight that I observed from the Beam Suntory case was not really a new insight, but it's a continued insight that risks in India in highly regulated industries such as this, which is alcohol, are high, and that companies need to put additional resources into India when they are in a highly regulated industry in that country.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, highly regulated industries in many countries merit additional resources from companies. And so definitely the alcohol industry in India would qualify for that as well.
So the next case was, and once again, kind of a renewed insight, perhaps, but the Credit Suisse case and improper hiring practices in China. The case certainly reminded us again, as if we needed that, I suppose, after JP Morgan, Qualcomm, and BNY Mellon. But the compliance risk on hiring in China, and kind of what did you garner from that case?
Yeah, absolutely. So given the heavy emphasis on relationships or Guanxi in China, improper requests for employment are certainly more likely to occur more frequently in China than in other countries. And this goes with our overall theme, right, of making sure that companies have the resources where they should in terms of their own organization in various countries and industries in which they operate. So in China, it's very clear that many different companies have faced requests for improper employment. And so companies operating in the country need to devote resources to make sure that they have proper systems in place so that improper hiring doesn't take place. And this can be through safeguards to prevent hiring and also the monitoring the effectiveness of the controls that they put in place.
Another facet from the Credit Suisse case was the lack of a corporate monitor. Obviously, or I would assume most of the listeners are aware that this year we've had a change or at least a formalization of corporate monitor policy in the Brzezinski memo. I know I butchered that name. Nevertheless, this case seemed to me to really fall in line, though, with several recent decisions by the SEC and DOJ around not requiring a monitor. Did you see that as an insight as well?
Yeah, and I think that's a very interesting insight. So according to Mr. Benskowski's remarks, the DOJ is supposed to consider a number of factors, including the type of misconduct, the pervasiveness of the conduct, whether the conduct involves senior management, as well as any improvements the company has made to its corporate compliance program. And the decision, in particular with Credit Suisse, not to impose a monitor is noteworthy because the NPA alleges specifically that the company failed to cooperate or remediate proactively over the course of the investigation, that the misconduct allegedly occurred over a period of 6 years and it involved an active circumvention of the company's existing compliance controls. So this settlement can offer insight into whether companies should expect the imposition of a monitor under very similar circumstances.
And finally, and the final case I wanted to visit with you about is the Sanofi case. And this I thought was really interesting because of the company's sales model of using distributors. And what did you see as, or were you able to garner any insights into what the SEC's expectations are around distributors?
Absolutely. I think there are two major lessons that we can draw from this case with respect to the SEC's expectations on distributors. So the first is that the commission will expect standardized controls. So, for example, the order implies that companies ought to have controls in place to standardize and monitor discounts, noting specifically that at the time at issue, Sanofi had no standardized commercial policy for distributor discounts and did not review the discounts provided by local management. So I think the SEC will be expecting companies to, in fact, standardize their commercial policy and review discounts that are being provided, especially at a local level. The second thing is the monitoring of outsourced distributor promotional activities. So the order cites an internal company audit that identified a lack of monitoring of outsourced distributor promotional activities, which included distributor organized roundtables, for example, that auditors said were not in compliance with Sanofi policy. So it's important for the SEC that there be auditing of distributor activities.
That's distributors are cases that we've seen over the past several years. And one of the things that struck me in reading this decision was, once again, we see several mistakes that were made by other companies, and the enforcement authorities, whether it be the Department of Justice or the Securities and Exchange Commission, really have to reiterate again what companies should do, particularly around the distributor discounts and the lack of standardization. So I thought this was a great lessons learned or learning tool for any company that does use the distributor model, literally in any country across the globe.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the Sanofi case in particular, the documents mentioned that there would be a 20 to 30% discount that was given to the distributors, which should be an automatic red flag, I think, just in terms of the amount.
Right. So there were some other developments. I'm going to say Petrobras to the end because we probably both have some thoughts on that. But the report also notes several key international developments. And I wanted to just get you, ask you, Anne, if there were some that might be highlights for you around the first one was the Argentinians look like they're finally going to get moving on their anti-corruption policies or enforcement actions. What do you see in that area?
Yeah, there was a very interesting story coming out of Argentina. In August, an Argentinian newspaper reported that a former government chauffeur had admitted to driving former Argentinian minister planning his deputy and others around the city of Buenos Aires to collect tens of millions of dollars of bribes in cash for delivery to various current and former government officials, including two ex-presidents and others. And the chauffeur actually turned over to journalists eight notebooks in which he recorded each of his trips collecting and delivering cash over a 10-year period from 2005 until 2015. As of this moment, the Argentinian authorities, as a result of all of the information they've received, have launched investigations into about 40 individuals, including former President Cristina Kirchner. So I think it'll be very interesting to see what happens with all of this in Argentina and whether this is going to turn into the Argentinian version of Operation Car Wash, which has been very active in Brazil over the last few years, as we've seen.
Well, Anna, I now know you are one of the firm's Russian experts, so now I'm really going to be intrigued to ask you about one of the topics raised in the report, which was entitled Russian Government Enacts Rules Exempting Companies from Bribery Liability. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So in August, there were new amendments to the Russian Code on Administrative Offenses related to bribery by legal entities, so by corporations, obviously. Specifically, now in Russia, a legal entity is going to be exempted from liability for bribery of a domestic official if it provides three things. So first is assistance in uncovering the misconduct. The second is assistance in conducting an administrative investigation. And the third is detecting and investigating a related criminal offense. So I just want to note that it's very important that the legislators excluded bribery of foreign officials and officials of international organizations from the potential exemption for legal entities, which is consistent with Russia's obligations under the OECD Convention on Combating Bribery of Foreign Officials in International Business Transactions. But this change in the Russian legislation is very interesting because it may serve to change the calculus for many companies in determining whether and how they might disclose and cooperate with Russian officials in investigations done by the government. Interestingly and relatedly, so Miller and Chevalier recently led a survey of business people in the Europe Caucasus Asia region, which encompasses Russia and other former Soviet states. And the survey found that 65% of respondents for Russia specifically noted that corruption is a significant obstacle for companies doing business in the country. At the same time, we had only 25% of respondents for Russia report that they're confident in the effectiveness of the Russian anti-corruption laws. So when we redo this survey, which is planned for 4 years from now, I'll be very interested to see if those numbers change at all for Russia in light of the changing legislation.
And then also from the international arena, we had a not only a very interesting case, but I thought a really important case around retention of the attorney-client privilege in internal investigations out of the United Kingdom in a court decision of the Serious Fraud Office, or SFO, versus Eurasian Natural Resources Corporation. Could you tell us a little bit about that case?
Absolutely. So this is a case that many of us have been following for a while now. This one is an appellate decision overturning a trial court decision. So ENRC, the company, had originally been told by the trial court that though the investigation, the internal investigation done with the assistance of counsel, was conducted in parallel with the company's disclosures to the SFO, the litigation was, quote, not reasonably in contemplation. And so, therefore, there was no litigation privilege. Now we've seen that the appellate court has determined that the litigation privilege should apply to attorney notes prepared during an internal investigation, even where a criminal prosecution had not begun, at least where there were allegations known to the company and an investigation by the SFO was anticipated. So the company had argued that once an SFO criminal investigation was reasonably in contemplation, a criminal prosecution was also automatically reasonably in contemplation. But the court disagreed with that. However, in its primarily factual analysis, it found that litigation in the specific case under review was reasonably in contemplation based on the contemporaneous correspondence with the SFO and the opinions of the lawyers for ENRC. The court also held that the legal advice given to head off or even settle reasonably contemplated proceedings is as much protected by litigation privilege as advice given for the purpose of resisting or defending such contemplated proceedings. So that was very interesting to see. The court also touched on another issue that many in England and elsewhere have been following, which relates to the English law notion of a control group. So this is a group within the company that's specifically tasked with seeking and receiving legal advice on behalf of the company. And the appellate court in ENRC said that although only the Supreme Court could reverse a finding that only disclosures made to this group would be privileged, it heavily criticized the existing rule. So I think it puts on the table whether another case might push this forward to eliminate or otherwise affect this issue of a control group within a company.
Lynn, I've been saving this for the end, which is the Petrobras case, and it was, by many measures, the largest FCPA resolution of all time, and certainly in the United States. There was a large credit given to Petrobras. The scope of bribery was about as broad as one can imagine. I think even in the deferred prosecution agreement, the government, the U.S. government, said there was no really way to determine the amount of bribes and corruption that actually were paid in this case. But I was wondering if you just might be able to highlight some of the noteworthy aspects from the Mueller report.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Petrobras case, as you mentioned, is remarkably interesting. I think, first of all, it's interesting because in Brazil, Petrobras is largely seen as the victim of many schemes. And so it's interesting to see that in America, it is very much not the victim, but the perpetrator. Some of the noteworthy aspects are that Petrobras preserved its sovereign immunity. It's the second primarily state-owned entity to resolve FCPA issues with U.S. authorities after Norway's Statoil DPA with the DOJ in 2006. But unlike the Statoil DPA, which includes no language addressing sovereign immunity, the Petrobras NPA makes clear that Petrobras wished to preserve its immunity. The second noteworthy point that I'd mention is that Petrobras executives served as both intermediaries and recipients of bribe payment, but no anti-bribery charges have been brought against them. So we'll see if any of them come up in the future, but at this point, they haven't been charged. The third point is that the DOJ insists on no piling on. This follows the recent release of its no piling on policy, and it's clear from the Petrobras decision that that the policy is taking effect here because the DOJ and SEC are receiving only 10% each of the total penalty, and the remaining 80% is being credited towards penalties owed by the company in Brazil. I think the settlement overall also demonstrates the continued collaboration between U.S. and Brazilian authorities in prosecuting FCPA cases, and comes on the heels of a number of other settlements, including Odebrecht, Braskem, Embraer, SBM, Keppel, and Rolls-Royce.
And unfortunately, we're near the end of our time, but I was wondering if anyone wanted any more information on the Miller FCPA Autumn Review 2018. Could you point them in the direction of where this should go?
Yes, absolutely. You can head to our website. It's www.millerchevalier.com and search under our publications for the FCPA Autumn Review 2018.
So I've been visiting with Ann Salton. Ann is counsel at Miller & Chevalier, and as she just said, we've been visiting about the FCPA Autumn Review 2018. Ann, I look forward to the next review and to continue with the conversation.
Thanks so much, Tom, for having me on. This has been great.
Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox again. I'd like to thank you for listening to this episode of the FCPA Compliance Report. If you have any questions, you can email me at tfox@tfoxlaw.com. Also, don't forget to check out Great Women in Compliance, premiering Wednesday, December 5th on the Compliance Podcast Network. I hope you'll join me again next week where we take a look at another issue, topic, or consideration on the FCPA Compliance Report. The FCPA Compliance Report and Great Women in Compliance are all a part of the Compliance Podcast Network.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.